How might the issue of abortion factor into voters' choices for the next U.S. president?
I think if abortion is to have an effect, it will be in the key swing states, right? It'll be in those seven swing states. Will the Democratic base be able to get more people out because of it?
An ominous UN climate report on the current rate of greenhouse gas emissions.
We are teetering on a planetary tightrope. Either leaders bridge the emissions gap, or we plunge headlong into climate disaster.
What experts are saying on both big stories.
Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news.
Hello, I'm Scott Walterman, here with Lori London in Washington.
Abortion is a contentious issue among Democrats and Republicans that could play a role in deciding the next U.S. president.
Former President Donald Trump takes credit for overturning the U.S. Supreme Court decision called Roe v. Wade, which established a constitutional right to abortions in the United States.
I was proudly the person responsible for the ending of something that all legal scholars, both sides, wanted and in fact demanded be ended, Roe v. Wade.
His opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris, has promised to reinstate a national abortion protection law.
Let me tell you something. When I am president of the United States, and when Congress passes a law to restore those freedoms, I will sign it into law.
Harris has enlisted big-name celebrities who've been joining her on the campaign trail. One of them was Bruce Springsteen, who spoke on Thursday.
I want a president who reveres the Constitution, who does not threaten but wants to protect and guide our great democracy, who believes in the rule of law and the peaceful transfer of power, who will fight for a woman's right to choose.
On Friday, superstar Beyoncé was with Harris at a big event in the U.S. state of Texas.
So what do the polls tell us about how much the issue of abortion might factor into voters' choices for president?
Joining us now is Clifford Young, president of Polling and Societal Trends at Ipsos, a global market research and public opinion company.
So thank you so much for being able to join us and talk about this.
Thank you for having me.
So I know that the abortion issue was credited in the 2022 midterms with impacting the race significantly. What are we seeing in 2024? Let's start with top of the ticket in the presidential race.
Yeah, when it comes to abortion specifically, abortion is an important issue. If it's not the primary issue. So the top three issues in America today are inflation, threats to democracy, and immigration. And if you put abortion against them, they're further, it is further down. But that's not to say it's not important. And that's not to say that it's not especially important for Harris. It's important for specifically the Democratic base. It really is a mobilizing factor. It also reinforces her credibility. I wouldn't say necessarily that, like I said before, that abortion is the number one issue, the number one deciding factor when it comes to who will be president or when voters think about a president, but it definitely is in the mix.
Right. And Harris is certainly banking on abortion rights as one of the major drivers for voters that care about this issue. And actually, it would seem, including some Republican women, when you say it's not the top issue, but what about for certain sectors like women, like younger voters? Would this raise the stakes for their priorities and how this could impact the vote?
Yeah, it's a niche issue. And so if you're talking about women, Republican moderate women in suburbia, it's a more important issue. If you're talking about Gen Z, some of the younger millennials, it's an important issue. But I see it much more as a motivator, as one of those sort of visceral issues that gets people out to the polls. You can think of the other side of the fence, issues, let's say, immigration. which for Republicans are kind of visceral. They go to identity. They're triggers. They get people sort of angry, kind of ginned up a bit, and get them out to the polls. Abortion kind of plays a similar role. So it's not to say that it's not important, right? And as we get closer to election day and as people vote, obviously, with early voting, we see how close it is today, right? And those issues that get people out of bed into the polls are critical, and abortion plays that role in my mind.
So you say that it's a voter motivator, and you can see that on the Democratic side. For example, Vice President Harris is holding an event in Houston with Beyonce. They're going to talk about abortion rights. Texas was the first to really jump on the state's ability to re-regulate it after Roe v. Wade fell. On the Republican side, they've been very careful what they say, and they sort of back away from it. Is it that they're more afraid of motivating the other side and rather than getting their own vote out?
No, it's a problematic issue, right? It's they're worried about their moderate middle, right? Those Republicans that are more moderate, those Republicans where this issue might be more important. I've already mentioned one segment of constituency, which are Republican suburban women, and so they're avoiding it. They're kind of wishy-washy on it. In some ways, we can think of it very much like inflation for Harris and the Democrats. It's a problematic issue because the administration was in the seat. The Biden administration was in the seat together with Harris during the period of time when inflation shot up. Right. And so they have a difficulty with confronting that issue because it doesn't help them. It's hard to frame it to their favor. Abortion operates in the same way for Republicans.
Let's take Florida, for example. It is on the ballot in Florida. Florida is not is expected to be a red state, as it always is, vote Republican at the top of the ticket. Do you have any data suggesting that it will alter any of the races in the state?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so we were very uncertain at the beginning of the cycle. I think things have shorn up more. We have a better understanding. Obviously, Florida looks to go Republican when it comes to the presidential race. But the Senate still, like, there's questions. If you get more people out, does that switch a bit? Senate races are always very idiosyncratic. It is on the ballot. So might there be decisions at the end of the day for certain people that would otherwise not vote, go out and vote, let's say. I actually think if you reflect a bit on sort of the voter calculus, people that are going to probably vote for the initiative probably going to vote for Harris. So for there to be a qualitative difference, the issue of abortion would have to pull a different segment away, right? I think it's reasonable to think there's going to be like a split ticket voting there where, basically I'm a Republican, I'm going to vote for Trump, but I'm also going to vote for the initiative. So there's fuzziness. I guess the answer to your long answer to your simple question is that there's fuzziness. I don't think it changes things qualitatively in the end.
Maybe in some states, would you think?
We shouldn't underscore the importance of abortion as a motivating factor. So I think if abortion is to have an effect, a measurable effect, it will be in the key swing states, right? It'll be in those seven swing states. And the issue is, will the Democratic base be able to get more people out because of it? Or might there be some moderate Republicans that could be carved off because of it? I think the former is much more likely than the latter. I think it's much more, it's a game of inches, but it's a game of inches based upon which side turns out more. And I think abortion is going to play a role in that way, one way or another.
Well, in those states, you're talking about razor-thin margins, aren't you?
Yes.
So
yes,
it could actually turn the election if the Democrats can actually make it happen.
Without a doubt. And so I've often said, you know, it can help on the margins. I've been criticized for saying that, saying, it's an issue that, you know, deserves much more, you know, much more weight, let's say. But and I don't mean it like that. When I say margins, the margins are really, really important, right? I mean, we're talking about 0.25% here, 0.5% there. I mean, will this election be decided by 200,000 votes or less? You know, there's a good chance that it will. And abortion could be one of those issues if ultimately Harris wins, could be one of those issues that defines the day. So I find it as a very important, sort of very visceral issue that it is a motivator for people to get up and vote.
Cliff, thanks so much for the information and the perspective.
Thank you so much.
That was Clifford Young, president of polling and societal trends at Ipsos, a global market research and public opinion company.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Scott Walterman with Lori London.
Current policies are taking us towards a catastrophic 3.1 degrees Celsius temperature rise by the end of the century.
The United Nations released a report that says if immediate action is not taken to reduce carbon emissions, the world will face catastrophic climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says it's already started.
Around the world, people are paying a terrible price. Record emissions mean record sea temperatures, supercharging monster hurricanes. Record heat is turning forests into tinderboxes and cities into saunas. Record rains are resulting in biblical floods.
Johan Rockström is the director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research.
It is a dark moment.
Governments in 2015 signed up to the Paris Agreement and a cap of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming to prevent a cascade of dangerous effects. But Rockström says we're not making things better, we're making them worse.
We're not making progress. Actually, we are making things more and more high risk, potentially even unmanageable for humanity.
Nations will gather next month at the annual United Nations Climate Summit, or COP29, in Azerbaijan, where they will work to build on an agreement made last year to transition away from fossil fuels.
It requires, to begin with, that the global emission of greenhouse gases are reduced by 7.5% per year between now and 2030, so that we cut global emissions by half by 2030 compared to 2019.
Joining us now for a deeper look at where we are and where we may be headed is Tapio Schneider, professor of environmental science and engineering at the California Institute of Technology.
So thank you so much for being able to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.
So this new UN report is out, and instead of talking about numbers and goals, because it doesn't seem to have an impact in the general population, if the Earth goes 3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times, what does the Earth, the weather, the climate look like to us?
I mean, first of all, 3 degrees Celsius in the global mean is not 3 degrees Celsius everywhere. It will be considerably more over land and generally. In general, much more over high latitudes, say in Canada and in Alaska, for example, and Northern Europe. 3 degrees warming will be probably about twice as much on average, could be 6 degrees in those regions. And it's somewhere 4 or 5 degrees or so over land, warmer, depending on where exactly you are. And of course, an immediate effect is more intense heat waves. You're just drifting temperature up. So every heat wave will be more intense than it currently is by that mean shift placed. It means more intense storms, more intense rainfall and storms especially. So for every degree warming, you increase the intensity of rainfall on average by something like 7%. So this will be like a 20% increase in the intensity of rainfall on average for 3 degrees warming, but more over land regions where the warming is stronger. So hurricanes like the ones we've just seen producing extreme rainfall, that will become much more frequent.
It sounds to me like they're basically saying we are on this path and there is no more time, that these governments have promised things, you know, to curb emissions and they're not doing it. And it sounds like it's getting worse. What are we looking at as far as a timeline for this planet and habitability?
Yeah, I mean, Earth will remain habitable, right? That's to be clear. It's not that animals or humans will go extinct, but it has severe impacts on human populations, especially in places that are already stressed by climate conditions, especially in places that are low-lying near sea level. Sea level will obviously rise just by thermal expansion of the oceans alone to stay below even the 2 degree warming above pre-industrial times, and extremely drastic emissions to stay below 1.5 degrees. In fact, so drastic that I think there's no realistic way to stay below 1.5 degrees warming. It's important to keep in mind, though, that these temperature thresholds are somewhat arbitrary. It is not that if it exceeds 1.5 degree, this or that drastic thing happens, or after 2 degrees, the next drastic thing happens. We need to avoid every bit of warming we can avoid, and that still needs to be our goal. So, say, even if we overshoot to 2 degrees, which may well happen, I would say is likely to happen, we should still make every effort we can to stay, say, below the 3 degrees, which is the current policy warming. I hope 3 degrees we will not reach. I don't know where in this range of temperatures climate will equilibrate. For climate to equilibrate, we need to reduce emissions to net zero. That's a huge lift, but that's achievable over time scales of the next few decades. What is not achievable is, say, achieving a 50% emission reduction in the next 6 or 7 years, which is what you would need to stay below 1.5, or within the next decade to stay below 2 degrees warming. But we need to reduce emissions. We cannot give up on that to avoid every bit of warming we can avoid.
How do you do that? So the top 20, the G20 countries, are responsible for most of the emissions. And the will to do what they have to do is simply not there.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say it's not just, of course, it takes will. But more, the will you need is mostly to shape policies that incentivize rapid technological evolution. I mean, obviously what we need is replace energy production, electricity production by burning of fossil fuels by renewable sources. We need to electrify everything, and we need to find ways of producing electricity cheaply and efficiently from renewables, photovoltaics, the forms of solar power, wind power, perhaps nuclear power. I mean, technologically, we know what it takes and it can be done. It is just a massive reshaping of our energy infrastructure, which has evolved over essentially a century. And it's not so easy to completely change that overnight. It will just take time to build the grid infrastructure, the storage infrastructure, if a large fraction of the energy comes from, say, solar power that we only get during daylight, and the production infrastructure. The typical power plant lasts a few decades. You're unlikely to shift them all off overnight and replace them by something else. It will just take time. And where it takes will is the political will to incentivize that transition for it to happen as fast as we can make it happen.
Right. And the big climate conference is coming up next month. Already the stated goals are not being met. And it sort of reminds me a bit, and it's probably a bad equation. I don't mean it that way. But, you know, these agreements just sound kind of like elusive, like peace talked in the Middle East, because they sound motivated and they have great ambition. But there's nothing binding. Is there another way to, you know, make things move at pace that they need to be going?
Yeah, I think the analogy with the Middle East, I hope, falls a bit short, is that at least here we know what needs to be done. We know what technologies we need to develop further and deploy at scale. What the solution looks like, I think, is relatively clear. What do we need to accelerate getting there? I would say in the U.S., the Inflation Reduction Act is actually a good example. It is quite effective in incentivizing policy change to technological change, mostly by providing positive incentives for the changes that we want to see, as opposed to, say, penalizing emissions of CO2, which would be another approach that would be favored by many economists, but has turned out to be hard to implement, carbon taxes and the like. I think we need these kinds of policies and more of those, and worldwide, at least in the G20.
So would you say you're optimistic about the climate future?
I'm optimistic that we'll find a way to a stable climate, meaning that temperatures will stop increasing. I don't quite know at which level temperatures will equilibrate. I do hope it will be less than 3 degrees. But where exactly we land, well, it depends, A, on all these problems we have talked about, technological changes and so forth. There's actually a wild card in there as well, which is that as we reduce emissions from greenhouse gases that cause global warming, an ancillary benefit of doing that is that we get cleaner air. And that's something we should all, of course, hope for. Air pollution right now kills around, or leads to premature death of about 8 million people a year. So cleaner air is an unambiguously good thing. But right now, the air pollution we are living with has a side effect of also cooling climate, meaning it masks some global warming.
Do you think that these reports and some of the comments from the UN and other scientists, when they say climate catastrophe, is that alarmist or is that realistic?
I mean, if you're in North Carolina and your house gets destroyed by intense rainfall from a hurricane, I mean, that's obviously catastrophic. And climate change is already leading and will lead to more extreme events, each one of which will be catastrophic for some part of the world population. I think it's justified to talk about catastrophes whose probability is increasing because of global warming. I think there's a subtext to your question. Does it help to say that or not in a public discourse? I don't know the answer to that. I think we're currently focusing a lot on the policy questions and what people think, but I think maybe what I want to emphasize and where I derive some optimism from is ultimately a lot of these questions are technology questions, and the technology is advancing irrespective of the political process. And for example, the cost of producing electricity from solar power has decreased by 90%, by about 90% over the last decade plus. There is a point at which it's cheaper to produce energy from renewables. And that point is already reached, say, for electricity production in many parts of the world. And at that point, it's obviously economically advantageous to use renewables, irrespective of policy. And I think we'll reach that point. Now, what policy can do is get us there faster. But I think I derive some optimism from the fact that all indications are that we will get to the point that we'll stabilize the climate.
All right. I'll take the optimism. Thanks so much for the perspective.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Tapio Schneider, professor of environmental science and engineering at the California Institute of Technology.
You've been listening to Issues in the News from the Voice of America.
On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thanks so much for joining us.
For more news throughout the week, listen to our podcast, The Issue, available wherever you get your podcasts and on our website at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.